Hello and welcome to the programme. When the news broke on Thursday morning that two girls were missing at sea after they went paddleboarding off Furbo Beach in Galway the previous night, as the morning wore on, hopes of them being found safe and well seemed to be fading fast. But around lunch hour, we heard the brilliant news that the girls had indeed been found by father and son, Patrick and Morgan Oliver. Everyone loves a hero, so it was great to hear from Patrick on Liveline as he told Joe about the rescue.
They were good, yeah. They were waving their paddles up in the air, yeah. They had us spotters before. They were waving anyway, and then we came alongside. They are weak there and tired, of course, like. But no, they were sitting up, and there were a little bit of chat out of them, like. But we got them in the boat anyway and brought them into the island, and the chopper landed there in the island. So
took them away, which is incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
But were they in swimsuits or full body suits?
Just swimsuits and buoyancy aids.
Wow.
And sitting up on their boards, yeah, yeah.
And Patrick, what did they say to you when you grabbed them on board?
They were delighted, yeah. They were fairly shook now, to be honest.
Yeah.
But they were very thankful, yeah.
And they must have been extraordinarily cold.
Yeah, well, to be fair, last night was probably the worst night in all the fine weather there now.
Yeah,
the last few days with rain and winds, you know. Northerly wind is usually cold.
And did you have anything? You have a trawler, have you, Patrick?
No, we have a potting boat there, Joe.
Ah, potting boat, okay.
Yeah, yeah. We thought at one stage we had them seen, like, there north of Inishere when there was a little, something came over the radio and it wasn't them, so we just kept going, that's all. And look, they were there, so it's good.
That's incredible. It's incredible. When did you hear that they were missing?
Very early this morning, yeah, yeah.
And would you normally go out? I know there's a great community and camaraderie, but...
Oh, we would, yeah. No, geez, anyone that goes missing there, yeah. There's always a few phone calls and everyone is up and gone, yeah, yeah.
Did you have anything on the boat? Did you have blankets, tea?
Yeah, we did. No, we brought a few bits and pieces, all right, yeah. We brought food and water and we have a few towels there. We've our own oilskins there. We wrapped them up in jackets and oilskins, put hats on them there to get them warm straight away.
So, Patrick, are you back to work now? What are you back potting again?
Yeah, I don't know what to do. When the lads told me to take the month off. I don't think so, no.
Patrick Oliver, as heard on Liveline on Thursday. By the time Drive Time came on air, the two girls had been named. They were cousins, 16-year-old Ellen Glynn and 23-year-old Sarah Feeney. Sarah's mum, Helen, spoke to Mary Wilson.
I was just walking the dog on the beach while they went in for the paddleboard and the beautiful evening that we had. And it was a gorgeous evening. We had a lovely chat and in good spirits. And then the next thing, they were just going out. I was with the dog and they seemed to be going out a bit far. And I started to be kind of like, that's a bit far. And it just went from the most serene of pictures to kind of a little bit of anxiety. And sort of then you're telling yourself, they'll be grand, they'll be back in a second. It's, you know, don't be, you're being dramatic here. And the next thing, obviously the time came as it was getting a bit darker, and they're two very smart, sensible girls. Luckily they had their life jackets on, which is obviously essential. The buoyancy aids have been, I suppose, fantastic, and paddle boards will never darken the door of our houses again, but just very grateful, you know.
So they had their buoyancy aids, but they didn't have wetsuits, they were just in their swimsuits.
You know, it was a beautiful evening, it was one of the warmest days, and they were only going in for a short little trip.
So they're out of sight. You're worried. Are you frantic at this stage, or are you thinking, no, they know what they're doing, they're experienced?
Yeah, it was just a very calm day. It's like,
yeah.
you row out, you row back in, you know, there was... Like, I suppose I was a little bit sort of, that's fair enough now, thanks you, for my own, I suppose, anxiety about water safety. But, you know, I figured I was being just over cautious and that they would be coming back.
As your anxiety grew, Helen, what did you do then?
Well, I went to ring my sister Ellen's mum first, and I started the call, and then I was again questioning myself, and no, give her a minute. I rang Sarah's dad. Then both of them came back, basically, and another friend and neighbour, and... You know, it was just getting darker at that stage, and I kind of at that stage had sort of been saying, they're not going to be in, I need to ring Coast Guard, and just made the decision and made the call to ring them, try and get them activated as soon as possible.
And sure enough, very quickly, the rescue services were activated. But unfortunately, because of the weather conditions, they weren't able to find the girls. Having spent Thursday night recovering from her ordeal in hospital, on Friday morning, Ellen picked up the story and told it from herself and Sarah's perspective.
Yeah, it was like we were just kind of sitting there waiting, expecting a boat to come. And then it was pitch black, I think, by the time we saw anyone coming. So then we're like, oh my God, they're here, whatever. So we started screaming, thinking that they'd hear us and see us, but no. They just, nobody could hear us screaming because it was so windy. And then it was we just were unlucky they didn't see us. And then the helicopter came after they did a few sweeps to the beach, and we thought the helicopter lights would pick us up surely because there was like high-vis strips on our life jackets, but the helicopter didn't see us either.
And at that point then, did you start to get scared?
Not really, because like at first when we realised how deep we were, we kind of got a little bit panicky, but we just said, there's no point in panicking, we need to just stay positive and everything will be fine.
Well, that is some presence of mind, because I've often told myself there's no point in panicking, and telling myself that doesn't necessarily stop it from coming. So that is, as I say, some presence of mind. But you were lucky in that you had flotation devices on, but you had no wetsuits on. What about the cold then, Eleanor? How was it? How were the conditions?
The water was warm, but as soon as the sun went down, it got really cold outside. And then the wind obviously was just getting heavier, and then there was thunder and lightning and big heavy rain and stuff, so we were absolutely frozen. We weren't really scared. I think that we were quite sure that we were going to be found. The only thing I was worried about was just how cold we were. We were shaking like leaves and frozen and everything.
Incredibly, the girls even managed to get a little bit of sleep through the night. When it became light again, they got their bearings, and through thick fog, they identified the cliffs of Moher and Inishere. Realising, however, that they weren't going to be able to make it through heavy waves on their paddleboards as far as Inishere, at that stage, the girls decided that their best option was to wait.
And did you ever think, you know, as the light dawned and you were there for a couple of hours waiting for people to come, did you ever think, no one's going to find us this far out?
We thought it was like evening time today. We thought it was about 5 o'clock, and we hadn't seen a single boat all day. We'd seen a helicopter in the distance, but we were like, nobody's even looking for us. There's no boats coming at all. And then out in the distance, we saw a boat and started waving our paddles up in the air like crazy. And that was the Olivers, and they came to save us. I didn't know that they were out looking for us. I thought they were literally out fishing. I was like, oh my God, thank you so much. Like, we've been out here since last night and nobody's even looking for us. We haven't seen a single boat all day. And they were just like, you've no idea the amount of people that are looking for you right now.
Ellen Glynn talking to Sarah McInerney on Friday. Another teenager who was on air this week recounting details of a rescue was Callum Keane. On this occasion, Callum was the one who had done the rescuing when he encountered two much younger boys in difficulty while he was out walking along the banks of the River Boyne in Navan. 16-year-old Callum spoke to Brian Dobson on Morning Ireland.
We were walking along the river, and then I heard a boy screaming like for help, and I see his friends like in distress on the bank. Like, call would be for help. So then, my first instinct was to, jump in and try help him.
There was one boy in difficulty initially, but there were two, is that right, that you got safely to the bank?
Yeah, there was one boy stuck in the reeds. He seemed to be trying to get to his friend to try help him. But he got caught in the weeds, so I kind of had to stomp the weeds down for him. But he got out onto the bank easily enough. But I had to carry the other fella over my shoulder against the current and bring him through the gap through the weeds and lift him up onto the bank.
Was that boy, was he out of his depth by the time you got to him? He was 11-year-old, so...
Yeah, he seemed to be standing on a big stone because it was his head above water and it was just up to his shoulders. So he was obviously standing on a stone or something, but he was, really frightened.
And the water was running fairly strongly, was it, at that point?
Yeah, fair play to him. I don't know how he didn't even get swept away because it was really strong.
As you said, he was very frightened when you got to him. Very relieved, I imagine. What sort of was he? How was he when you got ashore with him?
Oh, he was a bit in shock. He was shaking, but he's really grateful. Him and his friends are all really grateful.
Yeah. Did you get to call an ambulance or anything like that at that stage? Or his parents?
They're already. The ambulance and the Garda were already underway.
And have you had much reaction?
Yeah. I wasn't expecting it all, to be honest with you. My phone's been hopping all night and all day.
Callum's proud mammy, Claudine, also spoke to Brian.
Listen, you must be just absolutely proud as punch, right?
Oh, I'm very proud, I have to say. I think it was a great thing to do. And the fact that he doesn't realise, you know, what he'd done and the bravery, I think that's great. He, he just doesn't seem to realise the difference it made, because when he came in and I met him, he was so calm. Now, he was shaking, so I knew he was in shock, but so I made a fuss of him. And, you know, teenage boy, he was a bit, I'd say he thought I was being ridiculous, but yeah, I'm very proud of him.
From Thursday's Morning Ireland.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to most sincerely thank the jury for sticking with this trial for so long, and for my Garda colleagues and for the prosecution team, on behalf of Amy Nile and myself. Thank you very much.
That was the very brief and very moving statement made by Caroline Donoghue on Wednesday after Aaron Brady was found guilty of the capital murder of her husband, Detective Garda Adrian Donoghue, following the longest murder trial in the history of the state. On Wednesday's News at 1, RTÉ's northeastern correspondent Sinead Hussey told Christopher McKevitt about the impact that murder had on the local community.
This was a murder that shocked Ireland at the time. It had been the first murder of a Garda since Gerry McCabe in 1996. But as you say, the small community in Lordship, it was absolutely devastating at the time because, you know, Caroline and Adrian had moved to Lordship. They had started their life there essentially together. They'd both been stationed, having left Templemore in Dundalk, and they'd built a house there. They'd had their two children, Niall and Amy. Adrian had joined the St. Patrick's GAA club. He played with the club before he became a coach there, and he was actually over the Og section of the club at the time of his murder. And the very fact that the killing happened right across the road from the local primary school, so close to the GAA club and on the main road back into Dundalk, which means that people have to pass by the credit union every day, including Adrian's family, if they're going into Dundalk. So it was a reminder every single day of the cruel act that happened in January 2013. But the community say that while there is reminders of what happened and what happened that night, there's also reminders everywhere of Adrian Donoghue and all the good that he contributed to the community. He was very involved in the GAA club, and they named a pitch after him. His number 8 jersey hangs inside the door of the clubhouse. They have a tournament every year involving the Gardaí, involving players from where Caroline is from in Kilkee in County Clare, where he's from in County Cavan. So today's verdict will bring some closure to them. There had been a lot of anger in the community because of what happened. There had been a lot of frustration too at not seeing a conviction before today. But that conviction is now common. While, as Adrian's brother Colm said, it won't bring Adrian back, the community here say that Adrian will never be forgotten for the sacrifice he made 7 years ago.
We also heard an excerpt from an interview with one of Adrian's best friends, Seamus Savage, who recalled the night Adrian was killed.
We rang another friend, Darren Cowan, who was a colleague of Adrian's, another guard, and I asked him, was it true what we were hearing? And he just barely fit to answer me yes, and that was it. So from then on, we just went over. Myself and my wife Therese went over to Caroline and Adrian's house, and it got real from then, because there was guard cars everywhere and they were stopping us with nothing near the house. But then Darren came out and we got in, and it was just, it was an awful sight in the house. It was just tears everywhere. And I suppose the worst of it was his two kids, Amy and Niall, upstairs asleep in bed. Went to bed that night, everything perfect, to wake up the next morning to their whole life being changed with the loss of a model father, is all you could call him. He was just brilliant with his kids.
Seamus Savage, as heard on Wednesday's News at 1. As Gardaí involved in this week's prosecution vowed to bring 5 other men to justice in connection with Adrian Donoghue's killing, we heard details of the lengthy investigation that secured the conviction of Aaron Brady. Primetime security correspondent Barry Cummins spoke to Mary Wilson on Drive Time.
Well, I remember, Mary, a year after the murder, we filmed for Primetime another report at that time where we went into the Garda station in Dundalk. And I suppose my question for them at that time was to say, well, it's a year on, what have you done? I suppose there was this expectation or hope or desire that people will be brought to justice quickly. And I remember it was Detective Inspector Brian Moan who brought me in, showed me around, and I got it. Once I got in and saw the investigation, I understood this was going to take some time because it was going through frame by frame, thousands upon thousands of hours of CCTV footage, cameras that have been taken from County Armagh, County Louth and different places, all relating to that particular night and some days beforehand as well. And also there was an analysis of phone records and cross-matching, cross-referencing. Because as you say, there were no forensics whatsoever. This gang was, it was many things, ruthless, it was slick as well. They were wearing balaclavas, using walkie-talkies, and they left no forensic trace. So Gardaí had to come about it differently. And it's taken 7 years or more than 7 years to get to this stage of the Central
Criminal
Court.
And involved the police forces around the globe.
It did. And while suspects were identified, and it was Adrian's colleague, Detective Joe Ryan, in those hours afterwards, was able to recount to his fellow officers and Adrian's friends who are beginning this investigation that the raiders, some of them had local accents, border accents, was how he described it. So based on that, Gardaí began investigations, and a number of people were nominated as persons of interest, and then eventually a person of interest might become a suspect. But there was about 200 people who were persons of interest, but this was whittled down and suspects were then identified. Aaron Brady was one of those people identified as a suspect. Aaron Brady didn't hang around in 2013. He decided to get to the United States. He went on a British passport, flew from Belfast to Newark. He was on a 3 month visa. Like many other Irish people, perhaps he decided to hang around in New York. He was 4 years there he was hiding out in Woodlawn in New York. But eventually, Gardaí had reached out to the Homeland Security Investigations team in America, linking up with these US police officers. And it was May 2017 that Aaron Brady was arrested on immigration offences and sent back to Ireland. Now, interestingly, Aaron Brady had expressed the desire to, if he was going to be deported, to go to the UK, because he had a British passport. But the Americans thought differently and they sent him home to Ireland. And he was on the run at that stage from a different offence, one of dangerous driving. He was jailed for that. And he came out in 2018 from that prison sentence out onto the public footpath out near Wheatfield Prison. And Gardaí were waiting and arrested and questioned him and then charged him within a few days with the murder, the capital murder of Detective Garda Adrian Dunne.
From Wednesday's Drive Time. Now, you'd have heard Barry referencing the input of police officers in the US into the investigation. Well, on Thursday's Today Show, Sarah McInerney spoke to one of those officers, former detective at the NYPD Intelligence Bureau, James Walsh.
It was unprecedented. I've never been involved in something like that. You know, we were getting real-time information from Ireland, and we were able to give them real-time information back. There's a bond between law enforcement that a lot of people don't understand unless you put a uniform on. One of the Garda, Brian Moen, told me a story about his children that just really, you know, whenever I got tired, I would think about that, and it would just reinvigorate me.
And then, given it was going on for the 2 years, and obviously there was a lot of effort being put in by yourself and your colleagues, what was the reaction to hearing the news of his conviction for capital murder?
I was extremely happy when I heard the verdict and wanted the justice for the Donahoe family.
From Thursday's Today Show. Welcome back. The announcement that Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden had selected California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate received lots of coverage on air this week. So who is Kamala Harris? Jackie Fox is co-host and producer of States of Mind, RTÉ's podcast on the American presidential election. And on Tuesday's Morning Ireland, she spoke to Audrey Carville.
I think a lot of people will be wondering who she is. I mean, her own parents were immigrants to the United States. Her father was from Jamaica, her mother from India, and their lives and her own have in some ways embodied that whole American dream. And she was born in Oakland in California, and she earned her undergraduate degree at the historically black Howard University in Washington. She's had a lot of firsts. She was the first black attorney general of California. She was the first woman to hold the post, and she was the first woman of South Asian heritage to be elected to the US Senate in November 2016. And as a senator, she has employed very tough questioning skills, honed as her time as a prosecutor, notably in particular during the Senate confirmation hearing of Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh. And there's a great quote of her going around online at the moment of what her mother used to say to her is that you may be the first to do many things, but make sure you're not the last.
Jackie referred there to Kamala Harris's robust debating style. Well, someone who knows all about her debating abilities is Joe Biden himself, since he came up against her when she was running against him as a potential presidential candidate, and she tackled him about his stance on a policy on segregated transport.
Vice President Biden, do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No,
do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education That's what I oppose.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a local decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. That's why we need to pass the Equality Act. That's why we need to pass the ERA, because there are moments in history where states fail to preserve the civil rights of all people.
NUI Galway law lecturer and political commentator Larry Donnelly was also on Morning Ireland on Tuesday, and he gave his perspective on Harris's attack on Biden.
The reality is that attack was politics, and I think anybody who saw Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush in the primary campaign in 1980 would have been astonished to see them present such a united front for ideas. So that can be, that can certainly be overcome. But certainly Kamala Harris is a formidable opponent. She's a formidable debater. But word is that she's also well-liked on Capitol Hill, that there are a lot of Republicans who do have respect for her. She is going to have to get down and dirty, as you say, to accomplish the agenda. She is going to be an activist vice president because of the presumptive nominee's age and related concerns about his capacity. She's ready to step in and do the job, and she has the energy and the vigor. And that's why, again, I would have been surprised if Biden chose anybody but her.
And later in the morning on the Today Show, Marion McKeown told us more about Kamala Harris's backstory and remarkably good-looking family.
Her backstory is fascinating. Her mother came from India. She came from a very wealthy Tamil family. Her father was a diplomat. She studied in Berkeley, where she met Kamala Harris's father, who came from Jamaica. He's still a professor emeritus at Stanford University. They were both super intellectuals. They got very involved in the Berkeley civil rights movement of the 60s and all of that stuff. Her mother was supposed to go home to an arranged marriage in India to a very wealthy and very prestigious man there, and she refused. So she stayed in California. She married Kamala Harris's father, but they divorced very quickly afterwards, leaving her as a single mother, essentially. So her family looks like an incredibly good-looking Benetton ad. Her husband is a very handsome white Jewish lawyer. Her brother-in-law is Tony West. He worked for Barack Obama in the Justice Department, almost became the Attorney General. Really strikingly good-looking guy as well. And I remember when I attended the event, just looking at the family going, my God, that's the best-looking family I've ever seen. Like, and as I said, they look like America. They're Jamaican-American, they're Indian-American, they're white, they're Jewish, they're everything. And I think she'll bring that kind of an energy of getting away from the grey old men of politics. And just, she's 54, 55. She's young and she's vibrant.
Now, you might have noticed some discrepancy in the pronunciation of Kamala Harris's name. Well, that discrepancy didn't go unnoticed by Ryan Tuberty, who was also able to tell us that Fox News presenter Tucker Carlson was corrected by a guest recently when he mispronounced the candidate's name.
Tucker Carlson was talking about Kamala Harris's nomination, and a contributor to his show decided to say, do you know what? You have mispronounced her name so many times, I'm going to call you out on it.
Tucker, can I just say one quick thing? Because this is something that will serve you and your fellow hosts on Fox. Her name is pronounced comma, like the punctuation mark. Look, Kamala. Okay?
Okay.
Seriously, I've heard every sort of...
Okay. So what?
That's how it is, Kamala.
Okay.
Well, but I think it's out of respect for somebody who's going to be on the national ticket.
Fair point. Kamala, that's it. It's not that complicated. Kamala. It's kind of like that Kamala they say in America. Like we'd say Barack, and people would say, no, it's Barack. But it depends on pronunciation. But Kamala is where we need to be going on that. In fact, in fairness to her, she got so she's so used to people not pronouncing her name properly that when she ran for the Senate, she decided to get children involved in her campaign so that they could help big idiots like me and others who simply can't get it right. Just by way of saying, this is the name.
It's not Kamala. It's not Kamala.
It's not Kamala.
It's Kamala.
Kamala Harris.
Kamala's for our schools.
Kamala's for affordable child care.
That's Kamala.
Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris for Senate.
I'm Kamala Harris, and I approve this message.
Yes, you do, because you've told us your name and how to pronounce it. Kamala Harris. Okay, that therein ended the lesson.
From Tuesday's Tuberty Show.
Absolutely devastating day for us, McCall of Fear and Drummond. Yes, it is, Mary, yeah.
That's Pauline McAuliffe, who along with her husband Simon closed the doors this week on the pub that has been in the McAuliffe family since 1945. She spoke to Mary Wilson on Drive Time.
We closed the door on the 15th of March on government instructions, Mary. And from then on, OK, you were kind of saying every week, we'll get there, we'll get there. It has never happened. For me, our place isn't big enough. Big enough in the sense that I would have to stop some of my locals and say, no, I have eight in here now, you've got to wait and come with your time slot. How could I do that to people I've got to know since I got married here since 1987 and tell people, no, you can't come in? I mean, people were coming in to us just for the chat. They'd go to the mat on a Monday. They'd come here on the Monday night. They'd have their chat, their chin wag. And you know what? It was just the local chat for some of the people who wouldn't be married. But you know what? They were able to come out and meet people. I'm sorry for today or from yesterday on. That's not going to be for them.
Do all your customers know now that you're closed for good?
Yes, they do. As I say, I met one customer and he'd be in his 70s. And I said to him, the man started crying. That to me was the hardest thing of all I saw. A grown man. And he said, do you know what, Pauline? I'm living in the fields. I can't come out. I can't go to mass, he said. And now he said, we can't go to the one place where we could go with the pub. That was absolutely heartbreaking for me.
And as a follow-up to that report, on Wednesday, John Cook visited McAuliffe's pub in Drummond, where he also met Pauline's husband, Simon.
1945, my father and his brother came here to buy our home. 1986, he passed away, and Paul and myself... Paul and myself, we gave it everything we could for whatever many years, 30 or 40 years now, whatever it is, and we tried our damnedest. But it's just, when I think of a look around and see the lads, these are my friends. This is going to be a huge loss to me, Paul, these lads, and it's just heartbreaking. But, like I said, if the bloody government had, instead of blanket ban everything because of what you call it, Leeson Street or Temple Bar or whatever it is, if they had said, look, every house run its own house, run it right, let the hand sanitizers and all be done, give us some bit of a subsidy.
John also chatted to some of McAuliffe's former customers.
Tom Cusson, will you tell me, Tom, you're 73, if you don't mind me saying. A wealthy bachelor farmer, they're all saying. Will you tell me, how often would you come to McAuliffe's pub?
Maybe 3 nights a week sometime, yeah. It's an awful lot now, missus.
Would there be many in here on a typical weeknight or weekend?
They'd be good, maybe 10 or 12 some nights. Well, if you don't mind, you'll talk to someone anyway.
You live on your own. I mean, is it an isolated area? Do you get lonely?
It's fairly isolated, no. Which is an old house within a half a mile of me. The winter time, half 4 in the evening, nowhere to go. It's desperate.
Okay, and what will you do now? Where will you go to meet and talk to people?
Nowhere.
PJ O'Donnell, you're a retired farmer.
Yes, that's right.
83 years young, you told me.
Yeah, that's right.
What would you talk about here at McAuliffe's of a weeknight?
Oh, you name it. We spoke about it here. They say you shouldn't talk in a pub, you shouldn't talk about politics or religion, but you could talk here about politics or religion. You could talk, I tell you, there would be big arguments here about who won the national in such a year, and there'd be all that kind of thing. We'd be discussing the local team's last outing, what chances have the next, Munster's chances, Limerick's chances, all sport, all the sport, talking about farming and history was a great old thing here.
Where else will you get that kind of chat?
Nowhere. You'll find no place else like that. This is the heart of the parish. The creamery is gone, the post office is gone, all the teachers are gone, the schools are gone, everything is gone.
From John Cook's report on Drive Time on Wednesday. Michelle and Seamus Flanagan were Catherine Thomas's guests on the Ray Darcy Show on Tuesday. Having lost their two babies, Saoirse and Fionn, following premature births, the couple have now begun the process of having a surrogate baby. Michelle spoke about how devastating it was to lose two babies.
Same NIC unit, same doctor, same everything as there was with Saoirse. It was a bit like, really, can we be back here again? How can we be dealt such a bad hand? It to us, that was probably where we found the hardest to get our heads around, when Fionn was born and we were back in the NIC unit again, thinking, is it going to be a repeat of Saoirse? What is going to happen? Mm. And unfortunately, it turned out to be the same as Saoirse. Mm.
Did you bury the two of them together?
They're side by side.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's that, Seamus?
Just in our local cemetery, Lestunan. So, a family plot down there. Mm.
Do you visit all the time?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. There's always fresh flowers on the graves. So.
Catherine asked the couple how they are finding the strength to embark on this new chapter in their lives.
I know this might sound very strange to some people, but we have two small little guardian angels and we are convinced that they're giving us the strength, because I don't know where the strength is coming from. Some days I'm like, how are we putting one foot in front of the other? And in the next hour you're having a Skype or a call with your solicitor or with the clinic, wherever, to try and, you know, suss out how surrogacy works. Because like most people, whether it be IVF, if you haven't done it before, you don't know what it entails. And this is the exact same for us with surrogacy. We hadn't done it before. Mm. We didn't know what the ins and outs of it are. So we firmly believe that Saoirse and Fiona are giving us the strength.
Someone else who's been through a lot but who still manages to remain incredibly upbeat is Steve Simmons, who spoke to Ryan Tuberty on Tuesday. At the age of 24, Steve was in a car crash, which he recalled for Ryan.
I can remember coming up to the crash and about 5 minutes after the crash stopped, and then I just passed out then. The last thing I remember, I couldn't catch my breath and I don't remember that. And I woke up then in the Mater Hospital, in the spinal injuries unit in the Mater Hospital. And then they noticed the nurses coming in, the doctors coming in, and they broke the news to me then.
What did they tell you?
The doctor basically told me I'd never walk again and I'm lucky to be alive. The extent of my neck break, he said he'd never seen nothing like it in his years of doing the operations.
And what sort of injuries had you sustained?
I fractured my C6, C7 and severed my spine.
And what did that mean then for you in terms of day to day, the body being and the care you required?
I need a full time care. To go up out of bed in the morning, dress myself, to wash myself. I need just everything. Care for everything. I can move my arms and I have good upper body strength, but I still need cares, like, for the rest of my life.
6'3", big,
yep.
Big man,
yep.
Security, rugby, very physical person. To have that,
yep,
kind of taken away from you at the age of 24, as you were then, you're now 25. Can you tell me what sort of impact that had on you when they started to tell you this?
At first, I was down about it and I was thinking, how am I going to come back from this? Mm-hmm. And then I just the support I had and the positivity with my friends, family, even the carers and all the places I was in, they just pulled me through. And then I just thought, there is life after a spinal injury.
And indeed, part of that life which Steve is busy planning entails building an extension onto his parents' home in Galway, which, with the help of money donated by Tuberty Show listeners, it looks like he's now going to be able to do.
Imelda.
How you do?
Well done, you. It was an incredible idea you had, because that figure of over 200,000 is now over 400,000.
That figure of €400,000, which Joe just mentioned there, refers to money raised on foot of a phone call from a couple who would only identify themselves as Dave and Imelda on Liveline this week, who promised to donate €200,000 to the Laura Lynn Foundation if Liveline listeners could raise the same amount. And as you just heard there, they did. Joe finished the show on Thursday with Jane McKenna, who founded the Laura Lynn Foundation with her husband Brendan in 2001.
I just want to say a huge big thanks to everybody and to Dave and Imelda for this, okay, in particular. Thank you so much. And to you and your team as well, Joe and Orty.
And what you want, and in fond memory of Laura and Elaine and all the other children.
Thank you very
God,
much.
God rest them.
Thank you. I see them blue for me and you, and I think to myself,
what a wonderful world. Welcome back. Now, you might have been a little confused if you tuned in to the News at One on Tuesday and heard those two well-known Sig tunes being played back to back. Justin McCarthy soon made sense of it all, however, when he introduced Bridgie DeCourcy, executive producer on Fair City, to talk about how the long-running soap would be making a welcome return to our screens in September. Bridgie explained how Carrickstown is coping with COVID.
Even though we have lovely couples who have been, you know, delightfully coupled for years, we actually can't have them walking beside each other. So we've come up with all sorts of ruses to keep them apart, you know, bicycles, ladders, all sorts of things that can actually keep people 2 metres apart. But also we're telling the stories of things like, we have a young couple, for example, who had only really just got together when the lockdown happened. So they've now spent the last 6 months cooped up in a tiny flat, driving each other bonkers while falling in love. So they're nice, funny little stories like that as well.
So where will you pick up on in the storyline then?
We've actually had to park everything that we were doing. We had a plan that took us through Christmas and into the new year. That was a wonderful love affair. That was a wonderful little family event that was getting quite chaotic and quite complicated. We had really lovely intricate stories. We had an intricate story of a murder whodunit. We had a court case. We had all sorts of things. Everything is parked. Absolutely everything had to be parked and we had to start again because we couldn't have told any of those stories in the sets that we have, in the areas that are available to us, with the actors we have available to us safely. We couldn't have done it safely.
So we know that things like affairs and liaisons and kissing, they're all part and parcel of soaps and telling these stories. Are you saying you can't do any of those storylines in the current climate?
Well, there'll be a lot of long lingering looks. There will be lots of things that happen just off camera when, you know, somebody's towel falls to the floor. There'll be all sorts of things that we'll have to do to suggest. So again, we're going back to a sort of a Preston Sturges variety of telling story and drama and asking the audience to invent in their own heads and to actually have to suggest things to them that they will then be able to fill in the gaps.
From Tuesday's News at 1, American author James McBride was Kay Sheehy's guest on Arena on Tuesday. In this excerpt from that interview, he sets the scene and reads a piece from his latest novel, Deacon King Kong.
Well, every Saturday morning, every first Saturday of every month, this magnificently good cheese would appear at the projects in a basement boiler room, and everyone from the neighborhood would come around to get the cheese. And so this is my description of the cheese. The cheese was free. It came like clockwork for years, every first Saturday of the month, arriving like magic in the wee hours in Hot Sausage's boiler room in the basement of Building 17. 10 crates of it, freshly chilled in 5-pound hunks. This wasn't plain old housing project's cheese food, nor was it some smelly, curdled, reluctant cheese material snatched from a godforsaken bodega someplace, gathering mold in some dirty display case while mice gnawed at it nightly to be sold to some sucker fresh from Santo Domingo. This was fresh, rich, heavenly, succulent, soft, creamy, kiss my ass, cows gotta die for this, delightfully salty, moo-ass, good old white folks cheese. Cheese to die for, cheese to make you happy, cheese to beat the cheese boss, cheese for the big cheese to end the world. Cheese so good, it inspired a line every first Saturday of the month. Mothers, daughters, fathers, grandparents, disabled in wheelchairs, kids, relatives from out of town, white folks from nearby Brooklyn Heights, and even South American workers from the garbage processing plant on Concord Avenue, all patiently standing in line that stretched from the interior of Hot Sausage's boiler room to Building 17 outer doorway, up the ramp to the sidewalk, curling around the side of the building and to the plaza near the flagpole.
From Tuesday's Arena.
We were quite bright, but we didn't apply ourselves very well. We were in the top class in school and we both done well in the junior cert, but we used to skip school and just hang out with friends or go drinking.
Caused trouble when we were in school. You'd spend a lot of the time waiting outside the office to see the principal.
Meet Helen and Radha, describing there what they were like as teenagers growing up in Lucan in Dublin in the early 1990s. Now, did they sound to you like likely candidates to join the Hare Krishna movement, to pack in school and eventually become Hare Krishna nuns? Well, that's exactly what they did, and they were the subject of this week's documentary on
Hare
One.
Krishna, 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 Hare, 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 Rama, Hare,
Radha and Helen now spent more time than ever in the temple.
That's Nathan Walsh, Helen's brother, who produced and narrated the documentary.
You say that over and over again.
Well, 108 times.
Multiplied by 16.
Yeah, 108 times is one round. And then you do that.
When the girls turned 18, they became Hare Krishna nuns and moved to an island owned by the group in Fermanagh.
You wake up at about 3:30 and the first programme starts at 4:30, and that's greeting of the deities or their gods, the statues. So you'd be up and showered and downstairs dressed, and there'd be some singing. And then they worship the Tulsi plant. And then there's your 2 hours personal meditation. Yeah. And then at around 7:00, wasn't it? There's Guru Puja.
That's for the spiritual master.
Yeah, that's the next program. And then there's a class about their philosophy. So that'll go on till about 9:00, was it?
Nine. Then you get breakfast. And then
you'd be starving.
Yeah, really starving. Because you're up hours.
Yeah.
There'd be no TV, no radio. No. The only music you'd listen to is Hare Krishna music.
Yeah.
And you may watch like some Hare Krishna DVDs there.
And read their books.
Only
and
no their news books.
So you'd have no idea of news.
This isolation sometimes got to them, and on occasion prompted a return of the old Helen and Radha, the ones I knew before they joined the Hare Krishnas.
So some days we'd just take the rowboat and we would row around, and we found if you row couple of miles up the lake and get out of the boat, you find a garage, and we used to go buy 7-Up
and crisps and chocolate, because you weren't allowed to eat that stuff, and we gorge on it and then come back. But then we'd have missed our classes,
or they'd be out searching for us,
and our teachers would be standing on the quay waiting for us, and we'd be rowing back. So we even went on the hop from their classes.
From this week's documentary on One, The Deadly Saris, which was produced by Nathan Walsh and Ronan Kelly. Writer Rosalind Dee wrote a piece recently for the Sunday Independent about her experience of losing her beloved husband Jerry 5 years ago. She received a lot of reaction to that piece, and on Monday she spoke to Sarah McInerney on The Today Show.
I was desperately lonely. People don't talk about the loneliness, and people say things, I think I've discovered from talking to other people, people say things to widows, maybe younger than me, who still have children at home. And they say things like, at least you have the children. I mean, that word, those two words, at least. If anybody said, at least, Jerry had a signature moustache, you know, and it was always a joke. In fact, for one of his birthday cakes, I had it done in the shape of a moustache back in the day. At least he didn't lose his moustache, you know. At least he saw his baby grandson. At least you got to Venice for the last Christmas. I mean, it really is cold comfort.
It didn't help.
No, it doesn't help at all. It doesn't help. You know, people say the maddest things, you know, but they mean well. They mean well.
So we're 5 years later now, and people do say time heals. You don't agree
that
time heals?
Well, I don't think that time heals. My loss today is as great as it was on that morning when I climbed those stairs in that hospital. I still miss Jerry every hour of every day. But my grief, it doesn't define me anymore. You know, I've realised now I can have not the same life. I'm a different person, but I can have a life again. The loss of Jerry is as great, but it no longer defines me.
And you have Jerry with you today. He's on a ring around your neck. He goes with you everywhere.
His wedding ring is with me everywhere.
And you speak to him every morning?
I speak to him every morning. Yeah, tell him what the weather's like.
Rosalind Dee talking to Sarah McInerney on The Today Show on Monday. That's about my lot for this week. To play us out, Claudia Boyle was Ronan Collins' guest on his show last Sunday, and she performed a really gorgeous rendition of Danny Boy. I hope you enjoyed this week's programme. So until the next time, goodbye.
Oh, Danny Boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen. Summer's gone and all the flowers are dying. Tis you must go and I must bide. But come you back when summer's in the snow, 'tis I'll be.
Twice.